Welcome into a new episode of the Colliner Podcast, recording Thursday, August 20th, just past the top of the 2 o'clock hour. I'm Alex Barth, joined as always by Alex Lovitz. We are powered as always by CNS Media. Lovitz, what's up?
Not much. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, actually. I just moved, and you know that feeling like when you first like set your room up and everything's like in its place and clean and organized, and like that 2 or 3 day span before you come to terms with the fact you're absolutely going to ruin it. You just have that false sense of like, I'm going to keep things this way. Like I'm still in that. So that feels really nice. Really cozy waking up this morning.
That's nice. Let's wait a week. Probably going to look differently. I am an extremely messy person. It's a real problem. And you know, I think it's something that it's on my bucket list. I need to really, or maybe New Year's resolution next year. I need to really start being cleaner and picking up after myself, because with that comes more discipline, which is also something I could use. So I hear you, man. It's nice though. When you have those first few days, you're like, this looks really, really great. I need to bring people over here so they see my living space, you know, not in a complete horrible manner. So
it's that's like, good. You know, when you move into college, that like first day and you get your room set up and you're like, I'm an adult. Look at me. Look at this. It's like, I'm back in that mindset for a little bit. It's nice.
Yeah.
But one other nice thing that's really cool about it, I was never allowed to have cable in my room growing up. My parents never let me do that. I never had it in college. I didn't have it at the last place I lived. But for the first time, I have cable in my room. So I was able to watch the Bruins and Celtics from bed yesterday.
Which was that's nice.
Cool and very exciting. I enjoyed that. Let's start with the Bruins, because that series is totally wrapped up. And we don't know their next opponent yet. We'll get into that in a bit. It could be one of four. But we did our last show. Was that a call and a curse? Did Tuca opt out that day or the day after? No, it was the day after.
It was the morning of game three.
Right, because I remember waking up and seeing that. So we never got to talk about that. I think we did and we didn't. We talked about kind of his comments, and I think some of it carries over, again, like from my point of view, normalizing athletes as human beings and understanding that, you know, putting family before the job, if anybody else does that, nobody blinks an eye. Just because he's a hockey goalie, shouldn't really change that, especially this year in these circumstances. But definitely a surprise to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot that could have gone on behind closed doors. I think Don Sweeney and Cam Neely had to have had a conversation with him. I thought it was interesting that they mentioned that, you know, Bruce Cassidy had not spoken to him about that decision. Right. He went directly to Cam Neely. Thought that was an odd little, crux of that story. Obviously family comes first. And this guy has a newborn kid, I believe, a couple more, and his wife's home. And apparently there was some sort of family emergency that was resolved. It ended up not being that big of a deal, according to sports media people in Boston. But he decided to opt out anyway. You know, you could blame the kid thing, blame the family. I don't think he was into this series, into the playoffs, into this whole situation from the start. I think that was pretty evident given his comments. I think that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, and it led to him leaving. I also think that this could have been somewhat of a mutual decision. I don't know, but either way, I get the criticism. I also get the defense of Tuukka Rask, but it seems like the Bruins will be able to survive without him anyway.
So I would say just the one place I'd be careful is with people saying, you know, I've seen people be critical that, oh, how bad could it have been if it's, you know, 2-3 days later and everybody's fine? We don't know what fine means, right? It could be somebody had something where there was an urgent, let's say medical. Let's say there's an urgent medical situation. They get rushed to the hospital, right? Maybe they're fine in that they're back home and they're resting, but it's still something where he needs to be around to help out with, or it's something that could potentially flare back up or something like that. So, you know, fine to me doesn't necessarily, you know, if I had a family member, right? Or yeah, I had a family member had to get, you know, it wasn't anything major, just a minor thing popped up, but was in the hospital for a couple days. And when that family member came home, you know, people would ask me how that family member was doing. I would say, well, they're fine. You know, they're fine. Mm-hmm. Like, there was still a recovery process. There was still restrictions, and I still had to be around to help out, but everything was fine in that, you know, the worst of it was over, and it didn't appear like there was going to be anything majorly consequential happen, although in the moment, we didn't know that, and it was, I mean, I was out, I was doing things, I ran home. So it could be something like that, where everything is now fine, but you don't, I mean, you don't know the totality of what's going on. So I feel for Tuukka. I'm never going to fault anybody for Tuukka first.
I think the optics aren't great, though.
Because, no, they're not. Absolutely. I mean, and that's unfortunate.
Well, and you could talk about his family all you want, but those comments still exist. It does not feel like a playoff game. You could have 5 minutes of coast-to-coast action, and still there's no atmosphere. And so I don't think he was able to light that fire under himself. And again, maybe he was distracted. Maybe there was a family situation going on in which, you know, that led to his head not being on the ice and not being invested. And obviously, if that's the case, fine. Go home, be with your family. You have your priorities straight. I you know, that's commendable. But the following day after he returns to the Boston area, he's going out to the, you know, Newton Country Club or whatever it is to play golf, and he's schmoozing. The optics aren't good. The optics aren't great.
No.
And I think that this is something that behind closed doors, the people within that locker room are looking at it differently or are treating the situation a lot differently than how they're portraying it to the media. This is a bulletin board material type of thing. And again, maybe they know something we don't. But if he did just leave and there wasn't this grand legitimate reason for him, you know, departing, that's motivation. And that might seal his future in Boston. He has 1 year left on his contract. Who knows what happens after this season, especially if the Bruins can go on a run with Halak in net. But I don't know. I think that'll... I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of his teammates looked at this as a slap in the face. And it's an interesting thing. But I don't know. My gut tells me that he could have probably stayed. And it was more than just a family thing.
Although, I mean, you mentioned the chip on the shoulder. It does, of course, bring the interesting question of, you know, how much better or worse are they with Halak? Because I'll tell you this. Halak looked really good. I mean, he had that one boneheaded play where I forget who he just tossed the puck to a member of the Hurricanes right in front of the net. But I mean, that's hockey. That had like goofy stuff like that happens. It's just that's part of what makes hockey great. But I mean, overall, you take that play out. I'm not sure how much more you can ask for out of Halak.
No, he's a good goaltender. He's really good. And we remember in the start of the season, he was splitting time with Tuukka and he was playing just as well as Rask. He obviously was a really solid goaltender prior to coming to Boston. And this is a sport in which players go on runs, especially at that position. And he's somebody who seems to do well in big time moments. So it's bizarre when you have a goaltender like Tuukka Rask leave, who is, you know, one of the top goaltenders in the NHL, according to most hockey fans. And you're still in a position where, you know, it doesn't really deter you. It doesn't really move the course all that much because Halak is a really good second option. And right now he's been playing really well. And it seems like the Bruins are also clicking on all cylinders, you know, outside of the net.
So they've got there's four possibilities they can face. Thanks to Ty Anderson from 98.5 for the examples. And he has a post up on 98.5.com if you want to sort through everything. I won't go through all of the possibilities. You can read them again on 98.5sportshub.com. But the gist of it is the Bruins can play Tampa, Philly, Montreal, or Washington. And I look at those four. I want Philly just because, you know, we'll talk about the Celtics series in a second. I it's such a good rivalry, Boston-Philly. And I think the Celtics are going to end up embarrassing the Sixers when it's all said and done. And just to get more Boston-Philly would be fantastic. I think the Islanders are probably the easiest opponent.
Wait, you just said Celtics and the Sixers, I believe.
No, I did. No. I'm saying after the
Celtics. Oh, sorry.
Okay, maybe I wasn't clear. after the Celtics are done embarrassing the Sixers,
okay,
see the Bruins have a chance to embarrass the Flyers.
Gotcha. I that's what happens when you half listen. That's my fault.
Like it almost, the hosts don't listen.
Yeah.
It almost happened. I forget if it was last year or 2 years ago, where there was a chance that the Bruins and the Maple Leafs were going to be playing a playoff series simultaneously to the Celtics and the Raptors.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
It didn't end up happening. I tried to find instance where that had ever happened, and I really couldn't find one. But I've always wanted to see that. And I mean, this would be pretty close. I don't think they'd quite overlap, because I think for the Philly situation to happen, that one of the series still going on like has to go on to the point where if the Celtics likely wrap up the Sixers quickly, there wouldn't be any overlap. But it's still close. So that's what I'm rooting for personally. So, I understand they're not the easiest matchup. I think I said this last time we did a show or two shows ago. I think Carter Hart is fantastic. I've had a ton of fun watching him. But give me all of the Boston, Philadelphia. Bruins can't play Montreal. Ty doesn't have that as a possibility. So give me Boston, Philly for the rivalry.
That would be awesome. I mean, the best matchup, it would be the Islanders, who, although they're on a run right now, they're walloping the Capitals, which I don't think anyone really expected. But I think the Islanders' storyline is decent as well, with Halak in net, who is a former Islander. But if you're looking at simply, you know, the rivalry standpoint, the two best options are clearly the Lightning and the Flyers.
I don't want to put Lightning or Lightning. That's a good team. That's a good
team. It's the best. That's the worst case scenario for the Bruins.
Oh, yeah. And they have that puck luck now. They won both of those overtime games. I want nothing to do with it. Like, put Tampa off as far as possible.
Yeah. So we'll see. I think the Bruins are playing good hockey right now. And, you know, I think Lightning Bruins series would be extremely competitive. And I might even give the Bees the edge on that one, given, you know, how quickly they put away the Hurricanes. But you can't beat the Flyers Bruins rivalry, at least relative to these other teams remaining, since, of course, the Canadiens are not a possibility in round two. So, yeah, I think you're spot on. Flyers Bruins, that would be awesome. And people are forgetting that prior to the season being suspended, the Flyers were playing unreal hockey, if I remember correctly. And it seems like they're playing pretty well right now. They have a 3-2 lead in that series with Montreal. So we'll see what happens. But the Bruins put away the Hurricanes in such a fashion that I think round two is going to be a good one for them anyway. And it seems like they're rallying around Halak. And they're looking good. They're looking really good. I think people are more confident now in that team than they were during the round robin play.
All right, let's move on to the Celtics. They embarrassed the Sixers last night. Sixers had a 14-point lead in the first quarter. Celtics went up by more than 20 right after halftime. I mean, that was just a thorough pantsing. I really believe that there's like a chip on Jason Tatum's shoulder when he plays the Sixers. Obviously, they passed on him first overall, right? You all know the story. They trade up to get Markelle Fultz. Danny Ainge moves down, still knows he can get his guy. I think there's a massive chip on Tatum's shoulder when he plays the Sixers. That was a ton of fun to watch. The Jaylen Brown 360, I actually stood up. I actually stood up and yelled. That was that cool of a play. Mm-hmm. And that Sixers team just looks beaten and brutalized. I don't think maybe they grab one, right? This is where we'd be talking about, oh, well, do the Sixers get more energized as the series shifts back to Philly? I actually wrote that in my game story last night. I'm surprised no, like, wet blanket killjoy people came at me on Twitter. Well, the series doesn't actually shift back. It's in the bubble.
What sarcasm.
This is where we're normally talking about that. But, no, I mean, I think that team is cooked and good on the Celtics. To me, the Sixers have maybe been the biggest fraud team in sports for the last 4 or 5 years. I think Embiid's a fantastic player. I think the rest of their roster is a joke. I mean, I guess Tobias Harris is okay, but he tends to disappear. I think Ben Simmons is the most overrated player in basketball. And the Celtics just seem to expose this team year after year after year. And I'm glad it's happening again. And maybe this is the final shot where Brett Brown goes out, they shake up the roster, and they admit the process was a failure. But to me, last night, that was there's a real chance that the Celtics finish and sweep this series, however the other two games go. That was the funeral for the process. That was a complete an utter unmasking of a joke of a team.
I think that game, again, if this does go the Celtics' way and they win in either four or five games, it solidifies the fact that Brett Brown's not going to be the head coach of that team next season. I like the roster. I don't think that the Sixers have a bad team whatsoever. You have to remember Ben Simmons is out, and he is...
But he's not that good. They were better in the seeding games. We talked to Dan about this. And he said they were different, but his numbers in his column seem to suggest they are a better team without Simmons on the floor. It's one thing if they want to play him as a power forward and let him operate from the post. I think he'd be really good at that. But everybody's convinced he's Magic Johnson, that this 6'11" guy who played power forward in college can randomly become a point guard because he's a good passer. But you can't be a real threat as a point guard in the NBA if you don't have a shot. And he doesn't shoot. Again, it's one thing to... you know, Shake Milton, somebody like that, have that guy bring up the floor, put Simmons in the post, and let him work from the elbow. I think he'd be very effective. That's not what, maybe this is more of a Brett Brown thing than a Ben Simmons thing, but they don't use him right. Is he a top 10 point guard in the league? I don't believe he is. Could he be an above average all-star power forward? Absolutely. He's a great passer, and he's great in the post, excellent defender. Like power forward, LeBron. He's not a point guard. He can't play guard, and Brett Brown keeps trying to do that.
Yeah, I think you touched on it. Brett Brown seems to be the problem. They have personalities in that locker room. They had two of them in particular who happen to be their best players. Joel Embiid are two of their, you know, three or four best players. Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. I think Ben Simmons is probably one of their two best players. But They are so fragile, it seems, and they just seem to not have any mental toughness. At least they had something there for a second. Obviously, we saw what happened when they played the Raptors last season and how, you know, unfortunate the ending was for them. They were close. They're good. I think they are a coach away from being a legitimate NBA team, a legitimate contender in the Eastern Conference, but they don't have the mentality to be there right now. Al Horford was not the answer, both from a leadership standpoint and from a playing on court standpoint. And Joel Embiid is not a guy who can carry a team, put him on his shoulders. He 34 points last night, but still, they got walloped. It was about a 30-point game. Another point to make, just going away from the Sixers, it's great to see Jason Tatum come back and play like he did after, you know, seeing how the Sixers quieted him down in game one in that second half. 33 points and 8 for 12 from beyond the arc. He was on fire. And it really is interesting to see these two teams go up against each other because the rebuild processes coincided for both of them. And it's so clear right now that the Celtics have been far more successful, have built a much better roster, have really top to bottom, just a better organization from the front office to the coaching staff and obviously personnel on the court. So it's looking good for the C's right now. And this is exactly what you want from a young team, especially in the wake of the news that Gordon Hayward is probably going to be out for the remainder of the year.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough. Did you see, apparently, so Gordon Hayward's expected to miss about a month.
Mm-hmm.
Would line up with when he was originally supposed to leave the bubble for his wife giving birth to their fourth child, right? So what is really a 3 to 4 week injury is probably going to turn into a 5 week absence, the way that timeline lines up. And apparently, I saw this morning, people have been DMing Robin Hayward, Gordon Hayward's wife, Robin Hayward on Instagram, asking her to have her labor induced early while Hayward is still rehabbing so they can get the 2-for-1. There was a rumor that the Celtics asked her to do it. And she posted something on Instagram saying, like, the Celtics never asked me, and anybody asking a pregnant woman to induce labor for basketball is an a-hole. And she's right.
Yeah.
It goes back to what I feel like has been the theme of the last 2 weeks, normalize athletes as human beings. But, like, calm the hell down, people. Come on. What are we doing here?
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's a bizarre move to contact the wife of a Celtics player, being like, "Hey, You know, you could still schedule that C-section. We can have him back right before the finals. It'd be nice. I don't know why you'd want Gordon Hayward to rush back right now. I don't see the point in it. I also don't know why you'd want a random woman to induce a pregnancy early. But, you know, here
we
are.
For the rings.
For the rings. Banner 18. The bubble Banner 18.
Name that daughter Banner 18. You can name the kid Banner 18 if it works.
But the Celtics will be fine with that. It's similar to the Tuca situation. The Celtics will be fine.
I don't know. I mean, there was in game one, right, when there was like a 3 or 4 minute stretch where, and it was a key stretch because the Sixers were rolling, when Tatum and Brown were both cold and Hayward seemed to carry them. He's also been their leading rebounder in the bubble. They'll be fine against the Sixers. It's once they get to the Bucks and the Raptors that I'm more worried about it, especially because like Kemba looks good now. He looked really good last night, by the way. Kemba looks good now, but with that knee, what happens when he's played 4 games in 7 days, right? Is he going to be able to put the team up, play the kind of minutes they need as that guy? And also, where does the rebounding come from? Are you going to have to play Enes Kanter more against a team like the Bucks, who he has struggled against in his time in Boston? So, no, I'm not worried about losing Hayward right now. Like, they should still – I think the Sixers maybe grab one. If they have any self-respect, they'll grab one because they can't go out like this. But I'm not worried about the Sixers. Once you get into the Raptors, or I mean, maybe it's not the Bucks. Maybe Orlando takes care of business. I don't know. But those are the two teams where I'm like, yeah, having Gordon Hayward might make somewhat of a difference.
No, he's. I mean, listen, he's a great, great player, and he definitely adds to this team. But the Celtics are pretty damn deep, if you ask me. And you know, the rebounding factor is definitely something that could play a role. But they're playing with a lot of energy. There are a ton of second chance points, it seemed like last night. I don't know. I think they could still make it happen. They're going to need some more production out of, you know, guys like Enes Kanter. Maybe Rob Williams has an increased role, although, he didn't play all that much yesterday. Grant Williams seemed to get the bulk of those minutes. I'm not trying to downplay, the removal of Gordon Hayward. But we've seen this before. They've had to play without him before. And if we're being honest, the odds are either him or Kemba or somebody else was going to, get injured during this playoff run. But hopefully Kemba stays healthy. And if he does, and you can continue to rely on him for 25 to 30 minutes a night, then that could maybe compensate for the loss of Hayward. Let's hope so.
Well, and I mean, just to kind of clarify, like, I still have them losing to Milwaukee if they face Milwaukee. I just think they have a better chance with Hayward. I don't know that I change any of my picks, but Hayward changes the way I feel about sure. some of the series. You think it's over? You think it goes to five? You think the Sixers get one or two?
I think they're maybe they get one. They're definitely not getting two. I'm curious to see they're playing again, what, Friday? I'm curious to see, how they come out Friday. The thing is, though, they had a 14-point lead against the Celtics, and they blew it. And the Celtics are pretty good. Unfortunately, they're in the position a lot. Went down by a lot. I mean, we'll see. They gotta take a lead and keep a lead. I don't know if they're capable of that with the Celtics team going up against them. I don't think the mentality's there. It seems like they're ready for the season to end. And I think that's the case with a lot of these athletes. You don't think there are some Hurricanes players in the bubble up in Toronto? As soon as the game ended, they're like, oh, thank God I get to go home. I guarantee you have a few of those guys on the Sixers rosters as well, and other teams. But when you're down 2-0, the writing's on the wall, I think they're out of it. I think this series is a foregone conclusion.
All right, so quick baseball thoughts, believe it or not, before we wrap up. It's been training camp. We're not even talking about it, mostly because nobody's allowed to go, and that sucks. But a couple baseball thoughts. Fernando Tatis, unwritten rules. Let me say this. That was, like, I heard the thing, and I'm like, all right, so he hit somebody who grooved him a fastball. That was not an easy pitch to hit out. That was down in a way. That had some movement on it. That was a good swing. And in terms of the unwritten rules are stupid. If they were good rules, they'd be written down, right? If you're not swinging 3-0, should you not be swinging 2-0? Like, what's the deal? if Tatis grounds out and the Rangers go on a run and take the game, then he looks like an idiot for not swinging at that pitch. But my most important takeaway from the whole thing was maybe if more hitters swung on 3-0, pitchers would pitch more competitively, not just on 3-0, but on any count they're behind in. Because, you know, you can't just get to 3-0 and get the automatic strike. If you know, all right, 2-0, 3-0, the guy's going to be swinging. Like, I'm going to pitch more competitively early on to avoid that. If batters swing more on 3-0 and pitchers pitch more competitively on 2-0 and 3-0, baseball gets more competitive and less boring.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe in this huge problem, baseball's found an answer to one of their issues.
Yeah, I don't know if that makes much of a tangible difference. I think, you know, you just don't fall behind 3-0. You're going to walk some guys. There's going to be a lot of situations in which you're going to have to throw pitches that are very hittable simply so you don't walk a guy. And if you don't want to be in position, throw more strikes early in the count. It's pretty simple. But this isn't the other thing that you had to mention with this. The other factor is they're up 7 runs. I understand the gripe. It's like, you know, people, you know, it's not like onside kicking when you're up 3 scores, but it's in that vein. I kind of understand it, but we're talking about the sport of baseball, and part of its problems are these unwritten rules and old timers trying to act like if you break them, you are not a real baseball player. And it's silly.
The whole theme of 2020 has been erasing these archaic unwritten rules of society.
Yeah.
Why can't we do that in baseball? Like, okay, they're up 7 runs. What if the Rangers score 8 that next inning? You can't rule that out. Baseball's the one sport where, you know, the game's really never over. We say it's not over till it's over, but you can have a 10-point game in basketball with 5 seconds left. That game is over. It's not over in baseball until you run out of outs. There's no clock. So I would add, too, Fernando Tatis, he has a home run incentive in his contract.
Yeah.
So should he leave money on the table just so the Rangers' feelings don't get hurt and his own manager's feelings don't get hurt? I'm sorry. That's pathetic. Shaming your own player for hitting a grand slam. And not just your own player, like a young rising superstar of the game. Shaming him for hitting a grand slam. If I ran that team, that manager, whose name is escaping me, would be out on his ass.
Yeah.
Pathetic.
So the one positive with this that I noticed is there were way, 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 way more people who were condemning the comments made by that manager who said, yeah, I didn't like him swinging on 3-0, up 7. There were way more people who were like, dude, shut up. Throw strikes.
Chase
like,
Tingler, by the way, which is an outstanding name.
Great name. Tinkler?
Tingler with a G.
With a G. Okay, that's better. But there were, like, you're seeing this turn in attitude within the MLB, which is nice because you need more excitement. I do think there's a line. I've been, you know, public in saying I don't like what Joe Kelly did to Carlos Correa and Alex Bregman throwing at their head with 100 mile priorities.
I would say,
but it's all in the name of excitement. No, like it's all in the name of trying to bring more drama to the game.
I would say the difference is, but it's different kind. It's a different kind of drama. What Tatis did wasn't malicious, right?
Yeah.
He was given a pitch to hit and he hit it. That's baseball. That's how that works. There's like what Tatis did. It was because of not so much what he did, but the situation in which he did it. I don't know that there was any time like if Joe Kelly, like if the lead was different, or it was a different inning and Joe Kelly did what he did. I don't think that changes how it's viewed. I mean, maybe if he hits Correa to allow the winning run, maybe that's different. But for the most part, like what people were mad about with Joe Kelly was his specific action, whereas with Tatis, it was more about the situation. So I don't know. I have trouble comparing the two there.
Well, I think it is somewhat related. I think it's just a lot of unwritten rules that are being broken. There's drama, there's people who are against it, people who are for it. There's this divide amongst baseball fans and people within the game over whether or not this is good or this is bad. And with this Tatis instance, I think we have finally gotten over that hump, it seems, of, no, you can swing 3-0. You can pimp a home run. You can celebrate a strikeout. And that's a positive. The baseball's been a complete failure this season, specifically in Boston. But the one...
Well, it depends how you do it. I'm very excited for Kumar Rocker.
Yes. or Al Leiter's son.
No, they're both good. Kumar Rocker, the kid's electric. Just yelling at the dugout after the no-hitter, like, give me... Although, apparently now, according to... why can't I think of any names? The old-school baseball writer for Boston.
Peter Gammons.
I can't believe I just forgot his name. They're not going to give the team with the worst record the first overall pick. It's going to be a combination of record in 2020 and 2019, which is complete bull. If you want me to believe this is a real season, treat it like a real season. And if not, then all right. If you want to make the playoffs, you better have been good in 2019, because we're going to include that in the 2020 record. Like, get the hell out of here with that. I'm sorry. Team in baseball, they should get the first overall pick. That's how it's been done every single year since 19, I think 67 was the first MLB draft. If that's how it's done, then that's how it's done. If you want me to believe, why should I believe this is a real season? Why should I treat it? Why should I commit to it like it's a real season if Major League Baseball themselves will not commit to it like it's a real season? I've been fine watching the Red Sox suck eggs for 2 months because they're going to get Kumar Rocker, who is awesome. If I have to suffer all this and they don't get Kumar Rocker, that's dumb. That's going to piss me off.
Well, if one good thing is, I think Rob Manfred and the powers that be within the MLB would rather see Rocker go to the Red Sox than to the Pirates or the Marlins. Come on.
They don't know what they want. You're going to trust those idiots to do the right thing after the last 3 months.
That's fair.
You're going to trust those idiots to do what's best for the guy who I think has the best chance to save the game of baseball? Like, get out of here with that level. Come on, you know better than that. Rob Manfred's going to make the wrong decision. He's going to give the World Series champion the first overall pick because I'm Rob Manfred, and whatever the option is, I picked the wrong one. They ask him paper or plastic at the supermarket, and he says, oh, no, it's fine. I'll just carry it in my shirt. Like, he rolls up a shirt like a kid. As Kendrick Perkins likes to say, if you put his brain in a bird, the bird would fly backwards, okay? The only person I trust less in sports right now than Rob Manfred is Mark Emmert, and I already went on that rant. But no, the Red Sox are going to get screwed out of Kumar Rocker, and it's going to be the perfect way for this stupid 2020 season to end. They can't even tank right.
Well, what was their record? They didn't play well in August and September of last year.
They were 500 last year. They had pulled up the 2019 standings.
They were 500 last year. They won, what, 84 games? But August and September were worse than, you know, April and than May and June.
No, they started really bad. They were bad at the end.
You're right.
Bad too.
Well, they had that 11-game road trip.
I don't think it means they're going to include just the end of 2019. I think it's some kind of composite record.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. Just do it. Do it the most simple way, and I think your point is spot on. If you want fans to treat this season like it's real, then you should probably treat the off season like it's real too, and the draft like it's real. If they don't do that, then, you know, I mean, it kind of just proves what we already knew, that this has been a joke of a season, and it will also mean that we watch the Red Sox throw out the worst pitching that we've seen probably ever for no reason. Which would be fun.
I'm going to be so annoyed if they don't get Kumar Rocker. Although, watch, they're going to get the first overall pick and not take him.
Imagine if they take, like, a Trey Ball.
Exactly.
They're going to get a Brian Johnson, someone who played both. Like, oh, we'll figure out where we're going to put him.
I'll tell you that if they pass on Kumar Rocker, that might be it for me in the Red Sox. I might just go follow Kumar Rocker.
I'm on the verge of that, dude. I'm on the verge. Listen, the Red Sox were my first team. It's the reason I fell in love with sports. You know, watching Pedro Martinez pitch back in the day. But the past, and I understand people listen to Red Sox fans say this stuff, but honestly, like, just John Henry and company make it very difficult at times to root for this team. And it just ebbs and flows of, you know, we are World Series champions. The Red Sox are World Series champions. And then, like, they have to rely on Chris Mazza to start a game. And I just can't stand it. I just want them to keep, you know, a good core intact, throw them out there and put out a winning product because they have the budget to do it. I think they have the roster right now to do it. The lineup's good, but there's no consistency. There's no stability. And it seems like they didn't even try to configure something that resembled an MLB pitching staff. So it's infuriating, and I'm upset. I'm not going to apologize for being upset just because the Red Sox have won 4 World Series, you know, since 2004. It's still annoying. I still hate this ownership, and you know, this team is impossible to watch. It's awful. Rafael Devers is the only saving grace. Well, he's playing brutally this season too.
No, he's kind of the slump. He actually had a pretty impressive home run yesterday. But yeah, Devers and
yesterday was the best game he's had all season. But yeah, prior to that, he hasn't been playing that well.
Devers and Bogarts, I would say, are the two bright spots. We didn't even get to Bogarts. We'll save that for another show. But we're up against it, and I know you wanted to touch on Tom Brenneman and that issue for Monday night. So
yes, this guy is incredible. This guy is something else. He's the play-by-play voice for the Cincinnati Reds, and prior, he was hot. Mike did not know it, and he threw out a homophobic epithet talking about the city. Was it Kansas City they're playing in? I think he called it the blank city in the world or something along those lines.
The blank capital of the world. He tried he said flags, FLAGS.
Yes.
I didn't hear the first part.
It was out of context.
He might have been talking about some other city. Like that. That's besides the point, though.
Maybe he was talking about Tobacco Row. Who knows? I don't know. I think that's the only context in which that would be somewhat acceptable. But even then, just horrible. And the thing is, he said it with the cadence of, and that's a ball outside. Like, he had the broadcaster voice when he said that. He didn't know that his mic was live, but he still said it like a broadcaster, which is bizarre. I think the craziest part about it is, like, yes, he didn't realize that it was live, but you still have the entire crew on this broadcast who can pretty much hear what you're saying at all times, specifically in their truck. They hear him say this. He's saying this to at least, you know, 5 to 10 people. I don't know what the staff is. He's saying this to a number of people who are hearing this all the time. So it's just a baddie, weird thing that he would do that. Like, just extremely offensive and careless. And it shows that he has no respect for the people he works with who has to listen to him say this. Well, and I'd venture to guess that it probably wasn't the first time he's gone out and said something like that, you know, well off air.
Right. And I mean, we've both worked in TV and you know, it's very possible, like you just said, it's not the first time and somebody finally got sick of it and a button accidentally got pressed that shouldn't have been pressed to send that out over the air. I don't know how you can't say the best part was the apology, though.
I didn't even mention the apology. The apology was incredible. So.
That's, my God.
Is that the most well-timed home run of all time?
That's up there. That's And then, I mean, he didn't need to call it. He didn't need to. First of all, hang on. They didn't need to have him do the apology during the game. I'm sorry. Throw out a commercial break. This is bigger than the couple $1,000 you're going to have to give back. Or you run that. You run a double break at some point. You're going to get a pitching change. You run a double break. There was no I am not trying to scapegoat Tom Brenneman in any way. But whoever the genius was who decided to do the apology during the game instead of in a commercial break, that's pretty careless too, because you're not giving that apology the weight it should have. You're doing a disservice to the people he's apologizing to by intercutting it with a baseball game. The home run obviously just kind of puts the cap on it. But even without that home run, there was no reason that should have happened. That guy, not as bad as Brenneman, but whoever made that decision, that person has some explaining to do in my mind as well.
It reminds me of Bob Uecker, and there's a great skit. There's a great bit on Howard Stern. It was Artie Lang and Norm Macdonald telling stories about Bob Uecker, who who would use the cough button in the middle of calling a play to, you know, to point to, you know, like he's in the booth and he's like, whoa, look at that girl over there. Except he said it, say it in a much more inappropriate way. I'll send you the clip after this. It's one of the funniest things I've ever heard. And if you know Bob Uecker,
you're on the radio or calling a game on TV, you have a little console in front of you and there's a button you can hit to momentarily silence your microphone if you have to cough or sneeze or whatever.
And so one of the calls is, there's a ground ball to third. Look at the chest on that trollop. And so it's a gather, throws on the first, that's out number one. And it's just like, without missing a beat, it was very professional. And for people who don't know who Bob Uecker is, he's the play-by-play, or was. I think he's retired now. He also played. He was a second baseman way back in like the 50s or 40s. And he was the play-by-play voice. He did a solo broadcast, I believe, for the Milwaukee Brewers. But you probably know him more so as the play-by-play announcer for Major League. Hilarious guy.
Just a bit outside.
Of course.
He's a wrestling announcer, too. I didn't know that.
He might. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. The guy's
the late 80s.
The guy is incredible. If there's one person I'd want to play a round of 18 with or grab a beer with, it would be Bob Uecker. He's incredible. He's one of my heroes. Anyway, the point is, Tom Brenneman did this in the middle of an apology. He didn't hit the cough button. He just said it. And the way he said it was.
It's the opposite. He was calling the game.
He was. He's
in the middle of his apology.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a man of God, and there's a drive out to left field, and the Reds are now up 4-0.
I wish he'd gotten into it. I wish it was more, I'm a man of God, and that one is struck to left. Like, I wish he'd, like, you know, that would have.
Well, it's funny, because I think psychologically what was going through his head was, you know, he said this. He said, this might be the last time I wear this headset. And then he sees a home run hit to left field. And I think part of him's like, I got to take advantage of this. I don't know when the next time I'm going to be able to call a home run is. And so he's like, screw it. I'm going with it. But there was no energy. It would have been legendary if he called it like it was this game-changing home run and went right back into the melancholy apology he was in the middle of. It was incredible. It's one of the funniest videos I've ever seen. I'm not trying to make light of what he said, but right. The situation itself is. I think objectively hilarious.
You can't help,
he'll face his punishment.
Can't help but laugh.
Exactly. It just, because it comes off as satire. It's literally like, this comparison's been made, it's like Brockmire. If you wrote that on Brockmire, a scene like that where he's apologizing for using a homophobic slur, and then in the middle of the apology, he calls a home run. That's hilarious. That is so funny. And this guy did it seriously, live on air, in a legitimate moment. And that only makes it funnier. I mean, that's just how you know, humor works. I'm sorry. So it was incredible. And apparently this guy's somewhat of a dink in the past. Like, he's made other comments that have not been great. Curt Schilling has come out to defend him, saying he's a great man, which... you know, is not, a, you know, if I was Tom Brenneman, I would not be happy about that endorsement. So I don't know. It was incredible. And I couldn't get enough of it. Unfortunate turn of events, but it turned into a extremely funny viral moment at the same time.
And I will never say anything like that again. I mean, that was in terms of the apology I think now the present has been set. You don't apologize for the games going on.
Yeah, and that's you made that point. It's like, whose idea was it to stick him out there in the middle of the inning?
I understand you have obligations to run ads, but this is a little bit bigger than that. In that moment, I think you need to have that recognition. But
yeah,
definitely. I'm glad I'm not the one making that decision. You got anything else here before we close it out?
I think that does it. I think that's it. We covered it all. A lot going on. A lot has gone on since our last episode. I think we got it all.
It hasn't even been that long. We got the trade deadline coming up in 11 days through the baseball trade deadline. So we'll get into that on the next show. We'll get into some training camp. It's just tough when you can't see it and there's no preseason games. It's tough. We'll try to get there. Because if we talk about training camp, the problem for me is, right, like last year I was there. I think you were there once or twice, either last year or 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we could talk about it. We could give insight. If we did it now, it just turns into Barth and Lebowitz read tweets. And it, nobody wants to listen to us just reading other people's tweets. Like, there's no entertainment value in that. So
yeah, maybe we'll get we'll get somebody who's been at training camp on.
I know
next week and have them. Yeah, you know a few people.
So we'll get into all that soon. For previous episodes, check out us. Check us out on Twitter. Give us the follow at Calling It Podcast, and make sure to check online clmsmedia.com under the podcast tab. You can find all of our old episodes, future episodes there as well. For Alex Lovitz, I'm Alex Barth. For the Calling It Podcast, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.